Thank you for downloading this edition of Wartime. Remember, as always, Wartime is fully supported by contributions from listeners like you. For more information, please visit wartimepodcast.com. I hope you enjoy the program.
From 1756 to 1763, the empires of Great Britain and France engaged in a worldwide conflict known as the Seven Years' War. Fought in all corners of the planet, this titanic struggle was the result of decades of tensions, and would ultimately determine the fate of empire by establishing Britain as the world's dominant superpower. Though the war would ultimately be a success for the crown, the years of 1756 and 1757 were anything but, and France seemed to have the entire conflict in hand. On this episode, we discuss what's known as the Years of Defeat, 1756 to 1757, in the second of a three-part series on the Seven Years' War. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Wartime. I'm your host, Brady Kreitzer. On Season 1 of the series, we're discussing the colonial frontier of North America, the people and events that shaped it, and the places and ideas that changed its history forever. As always, remember, history is best when it's shared, and you can follow me on Twitter, at Brady Kreitzer, on my author's website, BradyKreitzer.com, and your home for everything wartime on the web, wartimepodcast.com. On today's episode, we're continuing our study of the Great Seven Years' War, the conflict that set the world on fire, and that Winston Churchill called the first truly world war in history. This is part two of the series. In part one, we've discussed the origins of the conflict in the year 1755. We touched on the experiences of George Washington in 1753 and 1754, and a year that produced mixed results for the British Empire, 1755. We talked about the four-pronged assault created at the Alexandria Conference, and the terrible defeat of General Edward Braddock at the hands of the French forces operating out of Fort Duquesne. On this episode now, we'll continue our discussion of the war, see how it expands truly to a global conflict, and break down exactly how, from 1756 and 1757, the French managed to create an enormous advantage for themselves in what was called the Great War for Empire. 1756 and 1757 in the minds of the British are years they probably would like to forget, known as the Years of Defeat. The British would see one defeat after another in all corners of the globe. It seemed that the French military strategy that they prided themselves so well in applying was winning the day, and ultimately, that the French way of life, that great antithesis to all that was British, would reign supreme on the planet Earth. But we say this is a global conflict, and for the first part of the episode today, I'd really like to focus on that idea, because if we do have any sense of what the Seven Years' War really means, the French and Indian War, only being the North American component of it, we generally isolate it to a North American viewpoint. But it's actually a much bigger and much more complicated topic than that. And if you don't acknowledge in some way, if not focus on completely, the European philosophies of the war, what occurs in North America will seem anomalous and remain misunderstood, or at least not understood to their fullest capacity in that regard. Let's begin. In many ways, some will say the Seven Years' War is merely an extension of an earlier war that lasted from 1740 and 1748, known as the War of the Austrian Succession. Now, we know that so far this conflict has taken on many different perspectives. It takes on many different looks. It's one of the wonderful things about the war. But in North America, it seems that European affairs couldn't be much farther. But I'd like to elaborate on that. From 1740 to 1748, we saw a war known as the War of the Austrian Succession that drew in most of the major superpowers of Europe into a massive conflict. And when that war ended, it seemed that a new order had been fashioned and placed in Europe. Little did the superpowers involved know that those same similar tensions that created the War of the Austrian Succession would rear their ugly heads in 1756 once again to create what we know as the Seven Years' War around the world. It's a complicated subject. It's going to take some background in European history, and though the focus of the series is on North America, this is a critically important part we have to understand. So let us explore the political dynamic of Europe in 1754, 1755, and 1756 to have a better sense of the entire picture. At the end of the War of the Austrian Succession, 1748, there existed an order, a series of alliances that seemed to be fairly permanent, that seemed to be fairly concrete, that little did the powers involved know would quickly disintegrate and completely transition to an opposite state. Throughout that war, we saw Britain and Austria largely face off against the powers of France and Prussia on the European continent, and they were involved in a very long and very brutal conflict that we've already talked about. It lasted 8 years. It was the War of the Austrian Succession. After that war ended, there was a new power shift in Europe, an entire paradigm shift, as a matter of fact, that saw the great superpowers of Europe in many ways turned on their heads by the arrival of a new superpower in the heart of the continent. That superpower that really emerged onto the scene in the War of the Austrian Succession was Prussia. Now, Prussia is going to be an interesting player for the rest of history as far as we're concerned leading up to today, because their stance and their perspective on governance and their role in the world, their, we can say, love for aggressive expansion, will completely shift the way Europeans think of their own continent. We have to understand this first from the French perspective. Whenever they view Europe as the major superpower on the continent, because remember, Britain is an island, they view it as a very good, sound opportunity to expand their own way of life by dominating the continent, and they'll form alliances to help them succeed in that regard. From Britain's viewpoint, they need to be the offsetting force. Britain and France are natural and perpetual enemies that in one way or another have been at war for the better part of 600 years. With those two motivations intact, you're going to see the arrival of Prussia as a superpower really shake things up. Prussia makes it very clear, and it does this through its actions, that its sole purpose for existing in the European continent is expansion. And not only expansion, but what we could say is aggressive expansion. Over the last 20 years, Prussia had made a lot of enemies in Europe, including Sweden, including Russia, including Austria, and yes, even France. Now, if Prussia is to expand the way it wants, what that means is that it's going to be gobbling up territories that belong to other peoples. Real estate is very scarce and very precious on the European continent. And it's that aggressive bend toward expansion that makes France greatly reconsider its previous alliance with Prussia as a nation. It's also that shift that draws Britain into the conflict. Britain, with its eternal enemy being France, begins to view Prussia as a very likely ally. If they're at war with the French, then the Prussians must be good for them. So what we see in 1754, 1755, and 1756 is a major shift we call the Diplomatic Revolution, in which the previous allies, Britain and Austria, and France and Prussia, completely switch sides in 1756. It now becomes Britain and Prussia versus France and Austria. Now, Britain has a reason for this alliance, and it has to do with their view of the world. Again, their primary objective is to fight France and beat them at all costs. But the way they want to fight the French is not the way the French really consider fighting them. Britain has two priorities. Number one is to hurt France by taking away its colonies and focusing most of their military efforts using their superior navy around the world. That means very little actual British combat on the continent of Europe. Their other, and perhaps more public opinion of the conflict, is that they have an obligation to a small German principality known as Hanover, in the middle of the continent as well. Hanover is the ancestral home of the British monarchy. So for that reason, Britain and the very small principality of Hanover have a unique symbiotic relationship. Largely, it's based on the fact that Britain has to protect this small principality in the midst of a very dangerous continent. Now, from their vantage point, the British, the Prussians on the continent as well, offer them the best opportunity to protect Hanover. The Prussians are in a good position to do it. In exchange for that, their natural distaste for the French makes the British and the Prussians natural allies. From the French viewpoint, their view of the Seven Years' War is much different. They believe this is the great war for empire, the be-all, end-all of empire, and they're correct. But the way they want to fight the British is almost a polar opposite of the way the British plan on fighting them. While the British want to use their superior navy to strip away colonies, ultimately bringing down the French Empire, the French administrators and policymakers have a completely different opinion of their way of fighting the war. They want to focus almost exclusively on fighting in Europe itself, and leave the defense of the continents completely to their own doing. Now, why would they do that? It's very unusual, it seems. It seems like a policy that's destined to fail. But the French have a larger view of how they want this whole thing to look. They have an end game. They have a long game, a way of thinking of it. And it goes like this. The idea for the French is that if they can defeat their enemies in Europe, they can, and particularly by capturing the city of Hanover, that British protectorate and ally, they can then bring the British to the table and negotiate for the release and surrender of all of the colonies they would lose otherwise. They believe that they could hold Hanover for ransom, a way of thinking of it in simple terms, and get back anything the British may have captured in the process. So if the British may have captured significant territory in India or North America, the French believe if they were able to capture just that tiny principality of Hanover, those could be dealt with in the peace process. They could gain that land back without ever firing a shot. So with that in mind, the French began to build an alliance. It's an alliance with the old British ally of Austria, also bringing in, to a degree, the Russians and the Swedes. Now, what do they have to do with it? Well, it all centers around Prussia. Again, Prussia has made it very clear that they are going to expand. And in the process, they make a lot of enemies. The Russians are their enemies, the Swedes are their enemies, the Austrians are their enemies, the French are their enemies. So these forces are sort of compressed together, not because they have a mutual interest in seeing each other succeed, but because they want to mutually hurt the Prussians as much as possible. Now, if you are Prussia, you've got a very big problem. Your problem is that the British have basically signed on to you to protect Hanover. And you will be responsible for the majority of the fighting in Europe. The British will fight around the world. At the end of the conflict, whenever the Seven Years' War is over, William Pitt, Secretary of State for the entire British Empire, will say that America was won in Germany, because the Prussians would do most, if not all, of the fighting on the European continent, while the British would fight overseas. Well, what the French have basically done with their new alliance, one that is completely the opposite of the war in the previous decade, was completely encapsulate Prussia with a number of very angry enemies, all excited to see Prussia fall. Sweden to the north, Russia to the east, Austria to the south, and of course France to the west. So in this way we say the Seven Years' War is a global war. And while we'll focus most of our discussion now with the fighting in North America, we should make it very clear that the events in Europe have a great deal to do with the way the war is fought all over the world. Now, we'll make this war seem like, the way we discuss it, as a North American venture only. But I want to make it very clear, we're only focusing on the North American theater of the Seven Years' War because of Season 1 of Wartime's dedication to the focus of the colonial frontier of North America. But it is a war that is fought all over the world. And it's endlessly fascinating to see how this war plays out in the respective regions of empire. Anywhere you see this war fought, typically, it will have its own regional name. There are some people that never refer to this war as the Seven Years' War if they're exclusively looking at their own theater of the conflict. In North America, the struggle between Britain and France, which really has been going on since 1753, even though war won't be declared until 1756, is known as the French and Indian War. Again, the Seven Years' War is the global conflict as a whole. In North America, it's the French and Indian War. If you look at the war in India, you'll see it with its own name. It's known as the Third Carnatic War, again pitting British interest and French interest together on the Indian subcontinent. If you look at it from the Swedish or Prussian perspective, that will be a major conflict between those two groups, both of them fighting as British and French allies, but fighting for their own nationalistic reasons. The war will be known as the Pomeranian War. If you look at the war that will develop in the process of the Seven Years' War between Prussia and Austria, this will be known as the Third Silesian War. So what we're saying is, yes, this pits Britain and France against each other all over the planet. But in most of these places, the wars themselves are fought by their auxiliaries, that are subjects or people who live within their empire, often with their own motivations and their own struggles at hand. So in a lot of ways, this war takes on many different looks. We'll focus on North America, the French and Indian War, again, the North American theater, to see exactly what we mean by this. But we've already touched on it a bit in previous episodes. It's worth reviewing just to get a sense of how deep this war really runs. The British and French have their own Indian allies in North America. And those Indian allies are fighting not because they love France, but because they have their own motives, aided by French war efforts. In the Ohio country, what is today Western Pennsylvania and the state of Ohio, we see the Shawnee, the Delaware, and the Mingo rise up in rebellion against their own imperial masters, the Iroquois. They're not fighting with the French because they believe in the French way of life. They're fighting with the French because the French war effort is providing them with weapons, ammunition, and supplies. All things that are essential to execute their rebellion against their Iroquois masters. In Canada, we see the great Seven Nations of Canada, the Huron included, the Abenaki included, taking on the Iroquois as well. Not because they love France, but because the French war effort empowers their own social movement, their own rebellion or revolution, if you would. And you see this is the case around the planet. And the more you look at the war, the more you begin to identify these small regional conflicts that really make up the larger struggle as a whole. We aren't going to focus necessarily on the European theater of the war. It's very much a Prussian, French, Austrian, Russian drama. But I would encourage you to look it up, because you'll see a whole new dimension emerge. We have to be careful that we don't consider the French and Indian War as just a standalone war, because you'll never understand the totality of the subject matter unless you comprehend it as a larger struggle of two massive European powers with their own plans and their own agendas. Now, let's get back to North America. Again, the strategy for the French has always been, let the colonies defend themselves. The French regular army will focus its efforts on the continent of Europe. The idea was, if the French can defeat their enemies in Europe, all parties have to come to the peace table, the negotiating table. They can get back anything they'd lose from the combat overseas. The British, with a much more powerful navy, kept the French at bay. The French believed they couldn't reinforce their positions anyway, and the British took the war to the colonies. That's the idea. And in 1755, we saw what we could describe as very mixed results. We saw a failed attack on Fort Niagara, led by William Shirley. We saw a disastrous effort, led by General Edward Braddock, to capture Fort Duquesne in the Ohio country. We saw some mixed success for Robert Monckton, who led an attack on Fort Beauséjour, and we saw the Acadian peoples, one of these small social groups sucked into this larger universe of war, have their lives changed forever. Again, the longer you look at the conflict, the more you begin to see the many layers and levels revealed at the time. But where does the war actually start? Well, war's been going on for 2 years in North America, we know that. But there is no official declaration of war by the British and the French, even though they know they're fighting one another in North America since 1754. really until 1756, because it's then that we begin to see the larger policies begin. We see the alliances harden, the new alliances from the diplomatic revolution, again, Britain and Prussia versus France, Austria, and to a degree Russia and Sweden, complete reversals of the previous war we saw a decade earlier, really begin to harden and really begin to be emboldened. And suddenly the war in America is not a secondary thought, but it's really truly viewed as a major shift brewing at the time. The French will be the ones to strike first blood. In 1756, France will launch an all-out assault on the British Mediterranean holding of Minorca, and after some fighting, will capture the island. Now, it's very clear what this war is going to look like. Whoever wins will effectively gain entire control of the loser's empire, and in the big picture sense, this is about Britain and France. But all of the smaller groups we've mentioned are going to benefit as well, depending on what side they take. When the French capture Minorca in 1756, this will lead to the official declaration of hostilities. The combat will end in 1763. It's why we call it the Seven Years' War. Again, if you just look at the North American portion, the war actually extends for 2 years beyond that. So Seven Years' War can be a very confusing term. But it's what we see already. The French strike first blood overseas, and while we're not focusing on the European theater, this will greatly change many of the opinions of what's going on in North America. Now, as you could guess from the title of this episode, from 1756 to 1757, and again, this is the great strategic be-all, end-all of empire. This will settle the score between the ancient and perpetual enemies of Britain and France forever. France will find a large amount of success with their strategy all over the world. For the British, they call 1756 and 1757 the years of defeat, because there was never a bleaker time in the British Empire early on than this. It seemed that the French were going to have their way. So what exactly did they do that gave them so much claim to so much success? Well, with the death of Edward Braddock in 1755, that was a painful reminder that the British are involved in a war that will be competitive, something they did not want to hear. And it cost them the lives of one of their most prominent and successful leaders in their entire imperial history. Well, the man that would replace Edward Braddock was named William Shirley, and you'll remember him as one of the only men in the four-pronged Alexandria Conference to calculate a battle strategy for 1755. That was not successful. He never even made the attempt at attacking the fort he was supposed to because of poor logistics. Well, Shirley will develop a new plan for 1756 that really singles out four targets, very similar to the Alexandria Conference, and it never really catches on. He's bogged down by disagreements. Many people understand he has almost no qualification to be the military leader of all forces of British North America, and he's very quickly replaced. The man that replaces him in 1756 will be Lord Loudoun, and his second in command is a man named James Abercrombie. Now, they do have success in their earlier history in service, but even they really aren't an effective answer for whatever the French are going to provide in North America. And this is a lot of the issues the British have. You have this adherence to an old aristocratic system, and certainly France has it as well, but it really translates in the British world onto the battlefield, and you see the wrong people at the wrong times in 1756 and 1757 making some of the most important decisions you could ever imagine. Now, these inadequacies are especially telling when you consider who the French have opposite them in charge of their military command. They have individuals spearheaded by men like Louis-Joseph de Montcalm and the Chevalier de Lévis. These are men who have fought in the War of the Austrian Succession. These are men that know how to lead soldiers on the field of battle. And it's Montcalm's ability and the Chevalier de Lévis' ability that really shine through in the earliest part of the war, because they orchestrate many of these terrible losses for the British that really bring down British morale around the world. Couple these with losing the Mediterranean island of Minorca in May of 1756 earlier that year, and you see a very dark time for the British Empire. So with our focus rightfully on the North American theater, let's look at how these individuals, Loudon and Abercrombie on the side of the British, and Montcalm and the Chevalier de la Ville on the side of the French, begin to play out. Because when we look at the events of the summer of 1756, we see major advantages in the side of the French command. If you could visualize the Great Lakes, we know the importance that the Great Lakes play to the overall French connective structure of North America, connected by waterways, rivers, and creeks. On the northern shore of Lake Ontario, you'll find Fort Frontenac, a very important fort for New France. Because again, as New France is a network of waterways, all goods, supplies, and men will shift and flow their way from east to west, really in a southward direction. And Fort Frontenac is the first fort in a line that is considered vital in the connection to Montreal. So if Fort Frontenac would ever fall, the entire really circulatory network of New France would crumble as well. So early on in the war, we'll see Fort Frontenac and the protection of Fort Frontenac be critically important for the success of New France. And this is where someone like Montcalm, a brilliant military strategist in his own right, really comes into play. Montcalm will feint, seemingly to keep his command at Fort Carillon, which is today Fort Ticonderoga in upstate New York. By moving to Fort Carillon, it seems that he's going to make another attack in the Lake Champlain, Lake George corridor, which really is the northern wing of New York State today. This would be a logical conclusion for many in the British world. Fort William Henry is there, and it's a direct line southward on the Hudson River to New York City. But what Montcalm is really counting on is not that his gamble will pay off because of his movements, but because of his opposites. Abercrombie specifically will misconstrue the move that he puts forward, take the bait, and leave his entire western fringe open. So here's what we mean. Montcalm will position his men in the east. Abercrombie is using Albany, New York, as a base of operations. It seems that the attack is going to be coming in the Lake Champlain corridor. And as Abercrombie prepares his men to respond to that, Montcalm will make a sudden maneuver to the west, suddenly to attack a fort known as Fort Oswego. Remember, we talked about Fort Frontenac on the northern shore of Lake Ontario as a vital French holding? Well, just opposite it, on the southern shore of Lake Ontario, is Fort Oswego. And whenever you see Montcalm make his attack there, his shift there, it's very clear exactly what's going on. The British are at a huge disadvantage. Montcalm will surround Fort Oswego and initiate a siege. With that, and at the risk on our end of getting too much into military tactics and strategy, siege warfare is nothing new in the European world. It's been around for a very long time. It was initially developed against walled cities, but a siege basically works like this. Walls are a wonderful thing for keeping people out, we know that, but they're also equally effective, with a little bit of tact, at keeping you in. So before you go building walls everywhere, just remember that. But that's what a siege is based on. An armed force will surround a walled city, or in the case of Oswego, a walled fort, and they'll begin to dig in. And the idea is, with the fort completely surrounded, no goods get in, and no people get out. Therefore, whatever food, clean water, or medical supplies that you have in your fort are all that you have. Now, the attacking army has to be a much bigger force, because a siege could take days, if not weeks, or even in some cases of the ancient world, months. But sieges will always work if the outside army, the attacking army, is big enough to surround the fort and keep it in that position. And that's exactly what we see Montcalm do at Fort Oswego. There was always question whether or not a European-style siege could be effective against a frontier fort like Fort Oswego, and Montcalm will put that to rest. Because ultimately, only after 4 days, Fort Oswego will fall. There will be a small firefight, but in the end, Montcalm will capture 1,700 prisoners from inside the fort. And not only the people inside are taken, but perhaps even more importantly, aside from them being taken off the field of battle, is the supplies within. Because there were over 120 cannon in Fort Oswego that was captured, to Montcalm's credit. What that's doing is giving the French a major advantage on the Great Lakes. Because with the fall of Fort Oswego, the British are effectively no longer a meaningful threat on Lake Ontario at all whatsoever. And while the rest of the Great Lakes are still very open, the real British presence, again, is only on the east coast of the Atlantic Ocean. So really, in a lot of ways, aside from some parts of Lake Erie, the British have very minimal presence on the Great Lakes otherwise. It's a major blow in a war in which the winner truly takes all. Now, it's very clear by this point that 1756 for the British cause may be a lost year. The losses at Minorca were staggering, and the loss at Fort Oswego, while more minimal in the grander scheme of the global conflict, meant that good news was not coming out of North America either. Now, it would fall on, at the end of 1756, both the British and the French to continue their preparations for war in the year 1757. And while the British commander, Lord Loudon, does have an ambitious plan, to his credit, the command and control structure of British North America, really of the British Empire as a whole, reveals itself to be an entirely inefficient system in this regard. Lord Loudon will make a stance that in the year 1757, he wants to strike the heart of New France itself, which is the city of Quebec. Quebec is a difficult catch. It's a walled city. It's a fortified city. In fact, today, Quebec City is only one of two cities left in North America that actually have defensive walls still around it. It's a big plan. It's an ambitious plan. But the inefficiency of the British command structure is revealed and how he has to go about it. Because before he can pursue that option, it has to be okayed in London. And in London, he does not get the green light. It's decided by William Pitt the Elder that he should attack not Quebec, but the defensive masterpiece of a fort that sits at the mouth of the St. Lawrence River, known as the Fortress of Louisbourg. Now, the fortress at Louisbourg is an incredible sight, and there are preservationists in the process of rebuilding parts of it today, but it sits immediately at the mouth of the St. Lawrence, and again, the St. Lawrence is that great lifeline of all of New France. It's part fort, part city, all trouble, if you're British at this time. And Lord Loudon has to really change his plans. Now, the biggest hindrance here is what occurs by the time he's sending his initial proposal and waiting for his response, because word only travels as fast as a letter can cross the Atlantic Ocean. There is no telegraph, there is no email, there is no instant communication. So with about 2, maybe even 3 months for the letter to get back to the government in London, and then you have to wait for the usual diplomatic overtures, and then another 2 to 3 months to get back to Lord Loudon in North America, you've already lost almost half of the year waiting for just what could be a simple verification of plans. It won't be that way. Lord Loudon will be redirected to attack the fortress at Louisbourg, and that will be a largely unsuccessful maneuver. But Loudon clearly believes his initial attack on Quebec will probably happen, and he begins to make preparations elsewhere in the British North American world to deal with the existing French threat in New York State, presumably, of course, Montcalm and his men, by leaving a sizable force at the very southern tip of Lake George in upstate New York today, called Fort William Henry. Now, while Loudon is beginning his preparations to perhaps attack the fortress at Louisbourg, a very important, consequential, and meaningful scene will play out at Fort William Henry in the process. And again, the issues of the day, having a lack of communication, are largely to play in the results. Montcalm will attack Fort William Henry in August of 1757, and the very long story we'll make very short, we'll see the French commander with 7,000 men surround the fort, put it under siege, the way he had did already at Fort Oswego, and once again be successful. The terms of surrender are very important here, because what you see is a collision of cultures that neither side is fully prepared to deal with the realities of. One of the things that Montcalm allows after his siege takes place, and it's a siege that lasts for the better part of a week, is that the men inside of Fort William Henry will be allowed to surrender with the honors of war. And what that effectively means is that they will refrain from fighting for 18 months, effectively taking them off the battlefield at the rate the French are going in terms of victory is concerned. And they'll be allowed to keep their muskets as well as a single cannon as a symbol of the perhaps generosity and mutual respect of the conquering enemy. It's a European system of warfare. It's something that, from the European vantage point, is very common. Is it deserved? That's up for debate. But it's very common to see in a situation like this. Now, the difficult part for us is how Fort William Henry is captured. Because remember, the French always have a number of non-Iroquois Indian allies with them at all times. In this regard, they're the Abenaki warriors of the region. Now, the Abenaki, when they view the surrender of Fort William Henry with their French allies, see this as a moment of great victory. And from the Indian perspective of war, whenever you have an opponent surrender, well, to the victors go the spoils. Again, the Indian world is a very physical world. And while for Europeans, something like a signing of a document would really show surrender, from the Indian world, a world without a written linguistic tradition, that's just not how, in their view of the world, which is very much a world of war, that a battle should end. Part of an Indian victory is the fact that they get to enjoy in the spoils of the war, the things they can collect, weapons, supplies, and yes, trophies of a gruesome nature, such as enemy scalps. Well, when Montcalm allows the British in Fort William Henry to retire with the honors of war, the Indian, the Abenaki warriors with them see this as a great insult. They say, Montcalm, we have fought with you. We should partake in this victory with you. And while you don't honor and value the same victory that we do, we should still have a right to enjoy the fruits of our labors as a result. It's a complete miscommunication at the time. At least that's the way it's viewed. Maybe they'll say in the European world, the Indians could not be controlled. But again, it wasn't really that way. The French were never in control of the native peoples. The native peoples were cooperating with the French for mutual benefit. Now, part of the surrender for the garrison of Fort William Henry was that the men would leave the fort and march a few miles south to a place called Fort Edward, another British fort. That was the plan. And after all, Montcalm had captured Lake George anyway, so there was really no problem. And this is a scene that we see play out very famously in The Last of the Mohicans. The soldiers will leave, they'll begin their march to Fort William Henry, and suddenly the Abenaki will attack the marching, defeated British soldiers, and they'll massacre them. Montcalm will try to stop the attack. Again, these British soldiers have no weapons, they have no ammunition. They're allowed to retire with the honors of war, but they can't fend off this Indian attack. And it becomes one of the first clear indicators that however this war is going to be in North America, the native peoples are going to play a role. And with the scattered dead British bodies that were supposedly to retire with the honors of war, there are not necessarily a single option of victory available to anyone. The Indians and the French and the Indians and the British are not on the same page, because the fact of the matter is they're probably not even reading the same book of what war looks like and what the rules of war entail. That event was August of 1757, and in the meantime, Lord Loudon will take his great attack at sea against the fortress at Louisbourg. It'll be a total disaster. The French Navy fends him off. Terrible weather conditions fend them off. It's not much of an assault at all. And 1757 begins to wind down as a very bad year for the British once again. 1756 was a series of devastating losses. 1757, it seemed, would be even worse. And around the planet, things are dramatically starting to swing in the favor of France if the British don't find a way to turn the entire conflict in their favor. Although the war in North America is looking very bad, it would be disingenuous for us as historians to say that 1756 and 1757 were completely without their bright spots in the larger British world. Because in India in 1757, British forces under Robert Clive recaptured Calcutta from the Nawab Siraj ad-Daulah, a French ally within India itself. Clive ultimately pushed the Nawab out of power, at what we call the Battle of Plassey in 1757, which gave a pretty strategic and lucrative victory for the British toward the end of that year. But it still begs the question, how can you have limited success in different corners of the empire, but not overall success across it all? And it gets the administrators in London to begin thinking, maybe this is our problem. Maybe this is our fault. We've seen the capture of Menorca. We've seen the disaster at Oswego. We saw the Braddock disaster in 1755. We saw the failed attempt at Louisbourg and the horrible massacre at Fort William Henry. Maybe this isn't so much where we're fighting, but maybe it's how we're fighting. And the British will begin to take a very stern look at who's calling the shots in the war and how they can change it. Again, the Seven Years' War is the great war for empire. It's the war that will decide the fate of not only Europe, but North America, India, the Caribbean, Africa, and East Asia as well. In the end, the Seven Years' War will be the largest war ever fought to that point in history, and there has never been more at stake. How the British and French play the rest of the conflict out will determine ultimately who wins the day, and whose worldview and whose great empire will reign supreme. On the next episode, we'll discuss 1758 to 1763, the end of the war. Thank you for joining us. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime.